My name is Arbutus O'Neill, and it is by the grace of God that I belong to the All Nine Family Groups. I am powerless over people, places, and things. And because of the program, I can make this admission today without feeling guilty. My life continues to be unmanageable when I fail to practice the principles that were given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to believe that the families of the early members of AA were convinced by the miracle of sobriety that this program would work for everyone. And it was out of this conviction that the Al-Anon family groups grew to reach all over the world and have shown astounding results. We subscribe to the concept that alcoholism is a family illness. And then we get so carried away telling people how sick we got that we forget to say, we have a program for family recovery. And that's what this weekend's all about. This is a showcase of recovery. We listen to the panels and the speakers, and some groups have Al-Anon sessions that we participate in. And we see whole families getting well together while they're having a wonderful time. And I'm very grateful to be a part of this weekend. This last year has not been the best year of my life. And I'm trying to find my place again. I've had many identities in my lifetime. A child, a student, a married woman, a mother. And I handled those pretty well. But I'm not handling this last identity that well. I don't like the word widow. But I do the best I can. And that's all you can expect. They call me a long-timer in the Al-Anon family groups. And that doesn't mean very much until you get to be a long-timer. And it's not hard to do. You just keep coming to meetings and stay alive and you'll make it. From some people who were very new in AA to come to their meeting rooms while they had a meeting. And that's what we did. We met in dirty little kitchens around the country and narrow, wide hallways, anywhere we could put a few chairs. And we sat together and we talked. Now, you know very well what we talked about. It was a kind of a morbid competition to determine which one of us lived with the sorriest man. And I wasn't very comfortable in those meetings because I didn't live with a sorry man. I lived with a fine young man who drank too much. And I wasn't very comfortable. And of course, Al-Anon is a kissing cousin to invention because they were both born of necessity. And these dear people who put the life-changing program of Alcoholics Anonymous together were visionaries. They knew that in time, the families would become aware of this necessity. And so when they wrote the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, they made provisions for us. Because they included in that book two chapters for the families of alcoholics. One of these chapters is entitled Two Wives. Now that is not intended to be a put down for you fine men who are members of the Al-Anon family group. Not at all. The truth of the matter is that when the book was written, there were no women in AA, so they addressed that chapter to the wives. The early groups in Canada called their groups the wives groups. And the other chapter, of course, is to the family afterwards. And down in my part of the country where I grew up in Al-Anon, we took a paragraph out of that chapter and made a preamble that we used to open our meetings. And this is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the alcoholic's family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problem. We feel that each family that has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes out of their hiding places. Former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others how we were given help is the only thing that makes our life worthwhile. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you have. The key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. My good friends, that's heavy stuff. That is heavy stuff. This paragraph has kept me active in the Al-Anon family groups ever since it started. This paragraph has made it necessary for me to travel hundreds and hundreds of miles and to talk to many, many people. And there's a little confusion about the literature in our fellowship. The literature that we developed in the Al-Anon family groups was intended to be a supplement to the first 164 pages of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We assumed, which is always a mistake, that you had studied those first 164 pages, and so we developed literature early on to supplement that. I have no idea how much literature we have now. I think we have upward of a dozen hardback books, each contradicting the other. And probably enough pamphlets to paper this whole room. And it makes me very sad. It makes me very sad because we're cheating our newcomers. I couldn't get well on what we're giving our newcomers now. I'm sorry. And I was extremely fortunate when I came here because I was exposed to the spiritual giants in this program. The Al Badgers and the Horace Forts and the Chuck Chamberlains and those people. And when I came here, I was absolutely scared to death. I was 1,700 miles from my home, right in the big middle of Texas, alienated from my own family. My father gave me his blessings when I left home to come to Texas with our four children. He said, if you're determined to go to Texas and live with that damn drunk and you go hungry, I don't want to know about it. And I came to Texas and I lived with that damn drunk, and sometimes I went hungry and he didn't know about it. Bill's family wouldn't accept me. They readily understood why Bill O'Neill had a drinking problem, because he married that Yankee from North Carolina where they make all of that liquor and them cigarettes. And these dear people tried to help me. But they couldn't, any more than we could help the alcoholic. It seemed to me that they took me up to the edge of a precipice, and they didn't push me over, but they just kind of let me dangle there. And I said to them, I don't understand Bill. I just do not understand him. Bill hates a liar, but he can't tell the truth. And and he's irresponsible. Half the time I don't know where he is. I don't know when he's coming home or if he's coming home. I don't understand him. And they said to me, read this book. Read this book. It will describe, it will explain the nature of the illness that Bill has. And it will teach you the philosophy that you need for your recovery. And that's what I wanted. I understood that. If you put it in a book, I believe it. And if you forget what you read, you can always read it again. I believe books. And that was the answer I was looking for. I attended my first open AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948. And I didn't want to go to that meeting. I was like the little girl in Illinois. I could see no constructive purpose to be served in associating myself with a group of people who, by their own admission, had ruined everything they'd ever tried to do. They'd ruined their health. They'd lost their families. They'd lost their businesses. Some of them had done terrible things and been in jail. Dear Lord, I didn't want to associate with that kind of people. I certainly didn't want to get mixed up with a group of them. I was having enough trouble with one of them. And the only reason that I went to that meeting was because I had put myself under an obligation to a very lovely woman who was married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you haven't picked up on the accent yet, it's not a southern accent. It's a hillbilly accent. And hillbillies don't like to be obliged to people. And I didn't want to be obliged to that woman. And so I went to the meeting. And I'll be forever grateful that I did go to that meeting. As I told you, it was an open meeting. There was about 150 people there. And you probably also picked up on the fact that I drink a lot of coffee. And I'm sure I'd made a number of trips to the coffee bar. And after we were seated in the meeting, a beautiful woman that I later learned was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous leaned across Marguerite and whispered to me. What she said was, "How long's it been since you had a drink, honey?" See, I didn't get here in such a great shape. Weighed 107 pounds. Bill said I had to stand twice to make a shadow. Elsa Chamberlain described me pretty well long before she ever met me. She said that people came to her meetings out here in California just two jumps ahead of a fit, and that's how I got here. Just two jumps ahead of a fit. And I was not embarrassed by the lady's question. I am not a teetotaler. I used to say I wasn't, that I didn't trust teetotalers, but I don't say that anymore. I've got a little friend down in Wichita Falls, Texas, that never even tasted liquor. She's a real teetotaler. And I would trust Mildred with my life, so I don't say that anymore. But Marguerite was embarrassed about it, and she answered the question for me. She said, "Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. I grew up in a house with two men, both of whom was my father. Dad was a two-fisted construction man who worked hard, he played hard, and he drank hard. Dad was a gray-eyed Irishman who taught me to love poetry, who taught me to sing Irish folk songs. He had the patience to teach me to work my geometry problems with his framing square. But on Saturday night, my dad turned into a devil. My father's alcoholism destroyed both of my parents. My father's alcoholism turned my beautiful mother into an old, ugly, bitter woman who hated him. She hated my dad as long as she lived. She hated my dad long after he was dead and in his grave. And the last years of her life, which she spent in total darkness, she hated anybody that had ever loved John Martin. And that included me. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. My dad was a craftsman, the likes you don't find anymore, and he loved to build things for my mother. It could be a china closet or a coffee table. And he'd spend those long gray days and the winters when he couldn't work outdoors and build something for mother. He'd select the wood very carefully. And he'd put together with great precision, as only a craftsman can do. He would sand it, polish it. I've watched Dad many times caress a piece of wood, much the same as a lady caresses a piece of satin or a piece of velvet. And he'd say of the wood, "This wood has a beautiful fault." And I didn't know what he was talking about till I found this program. But he would build these things for Mother, and as I say, polish them and sand them and truly make a thing of beauty. And then he would smash it in a drunken fury. My father's alcoholism destroyed both my parents. And for many years after I found the courage to ask the God of my understanding for special favors, I closed every day of my life with a special prayer for my father. God, don't let my dad die drunk. I cannot tell you why this is such a terror to those of us who love alcoholics. I cannot tell you. I can only tell you that it is. God, don't let my dad die drunk. My father died in 1965. He had cancer of the throat. He did not die drunk. And when my brother Mike called to tell me that Dad was terminally ill, he said, "We're going to have to pray extra hard for Dad Arbutus. He's not going to make it." And I said, "No, no." And you know very well I didn't want that filthy stuff to destroy that beautiful baritone voice. You know I didn't. You know I didn't want that filthy stuff to make it impossible for my father to even drink water. You know I didn't. But I prayed, "God, don't let my dad die drunk." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And I want you to know that when I married that tall Texan that was to become the father of my children, I was not concerned with Bill's drinking. Not in the slightest. Father Martin says the only way you can identify an alcoholic is by the one that you know. And Bill didn't drink like Dad. Dad was a hallucinating drunk who saw creeping, crawling things, and he really didn't intend to hurt Mother when he broke her jaw. He just intended to kill a centipede that was crawling in her hair. And Mother couldn't understand that. I'm quite sure I couldn't understand that either. But Bill didn't drink like that. Bill was the life of the party drunk. He crashed debutantes' parties and taught them to put your little foot. He didn't drink like Bill. And we worked for an advertising company that sent us all over the United States, and we got drunk everywhere we went. It was exceedingly important in my generation to have fun. one of my friends, an AA lady, said she had so much fun it liked to kill her. And that's about what happened to Bill and me. But we got drunk everywhere we went. Good Lord of mercy, we have been so drunk in Los Angeles. We got drunk in San Francisco, Chicago, St. Louis, San Antonio, anywhere we went. But then in 1940, two things happened that should have made Bill and me grow up. We became parents. And the world became involved in the war. And I quit drinking with Bill. Things were too serious. I was watching troop movements in Europe and later in the South Pacific because both of my brothers were in the military. A number of Bill's cousins and brothers were in the military. I didn't drink with Bill anymore. We had our second child the next year, and I wasn't there when Nancy was born. Nancy came on Wednesday, but she didn't meet her dad till Sunday. And when Bill came to the hospital in Cincinnati, Ohio, with the usual paraphernalia that you men bring to us when we have your babies, he caused a great deal of confusion in the hospital. Because he wanted to teach the Catholic nun who was in charge of the maternity ward the Texas stomp, and the good sister didn't want to dance. And when he left the hospital and sat down on the streetcar track in full view of my window, forced the motorman to stop so I could tell him about our new baby girl. You see, Bill was still having fun with his drinking. Then the next year we had our only son. Now don't get nervous. There's not that many of them. We had our only son. And this time the trip to the delivery room was a little different. Something went wrong. And they needed Bill. And they couldn't find Bill. Had I been able to talk to them, I could have told them that he'd be in a bar, but I didn't know which one. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. Couldn't talk about this for a long time because of the guilt that I felt. We had two little girls. And Bill wanted a little boy. I guess all of you men want a son. I manipulated that pregnancy. And I gave Bill a son who couldn't walk. Luther was born with a birth defect, and the doctors told us he'd never walk. And I was absolutely and totally overwhelmed with guilt. And I spent days and weeks and months taking that child to one crippled children's hospital after another to find a doctor that would make my son walk. I didn't pray for Luther to walk because I had nothing to pray to. But I believed in doctors. And from one hospital to the other, I took that little boy to find a doctor to make my son walk. Teresa, our fourth child, was born a year and 3 days after Luther was born. And gratefully, Teresa was one of those healthy babies that thrived on loving neglect. And that's all she got. Because I was determined that that boy would walk. And he did walk when he was 3 years old. Dad had gone to town to do some shopping for me, and he bought a pair of red corduroy overalls for Luther, and the straps were too long. So I adjusted the buttons on the straps and put those overalls on Luther and stood him up in the living room from me, and he said to Luther, "Walk over here to me, son." And Luther took 9 steps, and we both cried. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And of course, the drinking progressed, as it always does. And Bill changed jobs pretty often. One of these jobs took us down to Knoxville, Tennessee, about the time they brought that atomic energy plant into Knoxville. And thousands of people came into that little southern town. It was a madhouse. People were frozen to their jobs. You all are not old enough to remember this. Landlords couldn't evict people from their homes and all of this kind of stuff. But we were evicted from a furnished house in Knoxville, Tennessee that rented for $50 a month for non-payment of rent. Now, Bill O'Neill had a good job. He worked for Holland Furnace Company. He had a good salary. He made commission on all the furnaces he sold, and he wasn't one bit reluctant to take a little extra money under the counter if he needed a furnace real bad. But we were evicted from a furnished house that rented for $50 a month. And I couldn't find a place in Knoxville. And I was expecting Teresa any minute. I finally found a garage apartment 70 miles away in a little town up in Kentucky. And I checked into the hospital there to see about terminating my pregnancy. And I learned that I couldn't go there to be delivered of my baby because it was for the exclusive use of the coal miners. And I could not go there to have my baby. And about the time that I learned that, they carried Bill home. Now, they'd carried him home before, but this time his leg was broken. He'd had an argument with his boss, and Bill O'Neill never won a fight in his life. He must have felt 10 foot tall when he drank liquor, because he'd pick on the biggest man in the bar and just get the bejabers beat out of him. And it was usually because somebody had been careless enough to use profanity in front of the ladies that were in the bar. But they carried Bill home, and Mother didn't know I was pregnant again. Mother was only 12 years older than my husband, and law mercy, she hated him with a purple passion. And I used to have these god-awful arguments. Bill would yell at her because she hadn't taught me birth control, and she'd yell at him because I was pregnant again, and I'm in the middle with my big belly. It was awful. But we had to go home to Mother. I get the picture. We got on a Greyhound bus. Peggy was 3 years old. Nancy was 2. Luther was almost 1, and he couldn't walk. And I'm pregnant. My stomach looked like a watermelon that you'd just taken one slice off. And we got on that Greyhound bus and went to Cincinnati, Ohio. I cannot tell you who was most relieved when we got there, me or the bus driver. And we go out to Mother's neighborhood. She lived in one of those restricted areas that didn't allow children, those fancy apartment houses. And it didn't have an elevator. She lived on the 3rd floor. So Nancy and Peggy held hands, and I'm carrying Luther balanced on my big belly, and we go up and knock on Mother's door. And she liked to die. She liked to drop dead. And I said to her, "Would you please go down in the lobby and help Bill, Mother?" And she said, "And what is the matter with him? Is he drunk?" And I said, "No, ma'am, his leg's broken." So she went down and helped Bill up the stairs and sat us down on the living room couch for one of those talks that you all know about. And she said, Arbutus, there's no doubt in my mind that you're the most brilliant child I have. No doubt at all. But it takes a damn genius to get in a shape like this. And because of the volunteer work that my mother had done with the Salvation Army Hospital, or the Salvation Army, I was privileged to go to the Salvation Army Hospital to have my fourth child, a charity ward, a Salvation Army Hospital. I don't think my friends in Texas quite appreciate this part of my story. And quite frankly, I'd like to leave it out, but my bill said I must not, because it's real good for you high bottom drunks. I'll wear those emotional scars to my grave, I'm quite sure. And then I was to learn about another agency called Welfare. And I saw the look of pity and disgust each time one of those eviction notices was to be served. And I saw the look of pity and disgust on the social worker's face when I had to go to a welfare agency to get food for my children. When she wrote on my application blank in bold black letters as if I couldn't read, "Husband is a drunkard." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. I brought those four children. I resigned my school at midterm in 1944 and brought the children to Texas. My grandfather was a wise old man, and he told me I should go to Texas. He said, a man is never successful where he's unhappy, Arbutus, and Bill is so unhappy. And I knew it wasn't easy for Bill to be referred to as the husband of John Martin's oldest daughter. I knew that it wasn't very comfortable for him. So he came back to Texas and got a job and found a house for us and got me a pretty little Mexican girl to help with the children and all that good stuff. And I brought the children out in 1944. And I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking. Never had I even heard the term. But I watched this boy lose everything that he had that he wanted to keep. My Bill lost his left eye in a drunken accident. And he could not stop drinking. My Bill lost his left arm in a drunken accident. And he could not stop drinking. And I watched this happen. And I wanted to help him. With every fiber of my being, I wanted to help him. But I couldn't. I'm going to say something to you AA people, and again, please don't misunderstand me. I would never want to say anything from this or any other podium that would hurt you. You've been hurt enough. But I've heard you stand at places like I am right now and say, a non-alcoholic don't know what they're talking about. And I want you to know that I know what I'm talking about. I've held an alcoholic in my arms through the long nights when he was in convulsions, scared to death that he wouldn't live till morning. Scared to death that if he did live, he wouldn't have any sanity left. I couldn't tell which one of those eyes was artificial. I know what I'm talking about. I've walked drunken women up and down, feeding them black coffee, and gone home grateful in the knowledge that but for the grace of God, somebody might be walking me up and down and feeding me black coffee to send my children to school. I know what I'm talking about. We're not calloused, insensitive people. We know the physical pain that you endure. We know the emotional torment. It seems to me that you put us on the other side of a thick glass wall, and we can see you and we can hear you, but we can't get through to you. I try to describe this feeling. It's the feeling that those of you who are parents can recognize. It's the feeling you have when you tend a sick baby. The baby cries, it's burning up with fever, and you want to help the baby, but you can't because the baby can't tell you where it hurts. And the alcoholic couldn't tell us where they hurt, and we couldn't help you. But God, we wanted to. There's some people here this afternoon, I'll bet a pretty penny, that would not be here if it was not for somebody like me. We wanted to help you. But we couldn't help you because you would not let us. And I want you to remember that the next time you tease an Al-Anon member. I had never heard the term alcoholism applied to Bill's drinking. And I came to Texas with a great deal of anticipation because Bill was one of a large family. He was one of 10 children, and he had cousins by the dozens. And I knew I'd have a support group when I got to Texas. But that was not true. As I said earlier, they understood thoroughly that Bill drank because of the influence that my family had had on him. He didn't drink before he married me, they said. He belonged to the Southern Baptist Church and did all the things, but I didn't have a support group. But then we met a strange group of people. They called themselves members of AA. And these people could help Bill. As I told you earlier, they could help Bill, but they couldn't help me. And I never shall forget the first AA member that I ever talked to. He came to my house in the middle of the afternoon, and he described to me what I referred to then as this rehabilitation program for the alcoholic. I didn't know anything else to call it. And after about 2.5 hours, I asked him a question. I said, "What do you have in this rehabilitation program of yours for the wives and children of alcoholics?" And nobody had ever asked him that question before, I'm sure, because he couldn't answer it. He said, "We don't have anything for the wives and children, Mrs. O'Neill. You do not have a problem." I thought he was wrong. Still think he was wrong. At that moment, I could not wear sleeves because of a rash that the doctor said was caused by nerves. I weighed 107 pounds. I was so nervous that I couldn't stand in my own shoes. And that dear man said, "You do not have a problem." And I believe with all my heart that it was that cold November afternoon when I stood in the living room of a mean little rent house in Brownwood, Texas, where we live now, that I made up my mind, someday, I will find a way to help the families of alcoholics. And by the grace of God, that opportunity came because I met another group of people. Now, if I thought those AA people were weird, oh, my dear Lord. Those non-alcoholics who found it vitally necessary to work this recover, that's 12 steps of the recovery program to preserve their sanity and to preserve their stability and to restore their sanity, they were scary. Their eyes were dead. I went to one of those meetings and it like scared the daylight out of me. There was one woman in that group who's twice as old as I was, and I worried about her. I was afraid she'd drop dead of a heart attack because she was so old. She was 58 years old. And Bill kept saying to me, "You need to go to those meetings." And I said, "No, those people are sick and I don't want to get like that." And when I came here, one of the girls that was talking this before I did talked about the inability to understand and how sick she got. She really was sick, wasn't she? But the thing that I couldn't understand was that they were so hopeless, and I mean it. You just nothing there, and they scared the daylights out of me. But God looks after fools and drunks, Mother said, and that's really what happened in my life. We got a new member in that little group in Abilene, Texas, from California. Her husband and my husband were cousins, and Tom went to work for my Bill. And Guy had been in Al-Anon. She was a good friend to Elsa Chamberlain's, and she'd been in Al-Anon for 10 years. And she came to our group. Now, our group had a preamble that incorporated the Constitution of the United States, the Bill of Rights, and the marriage ceremony. And admonished us to be virtuous and modest. I flunked. Our primary purpose was to provide entertainment for the AA people. I'm not an entertainer. And Guy came to the meeting and they read that preamble. And those little size 5 feet hit the floor, and she said, "What in the hell do you think you're doing?" And to say she turned that group around was an understatement. And we met on Thursdays and Monday nights. And I worked 52 hours a week. Texas wouldn't recognize my teaching certification because I hadn't studied Texas history, so they wouldn't let me teach school. And I wouldn't go back and study Texas history, so it was a Mexican standoff. But I worked 52 hours at a minimum wage job. I lived in a 12-room house, kept 4 children in school, and ran a one-parent household for 15 years till Bill got us out of debt. So I was a pretty busy person. And, of course, when Bill came home on weekends, the house had to pass a white glove inspection, my decision, not Bill's. And I didn't always make the Monday night meeting because I had to put that house together Monday morning. It looked like a herd of buffalo had gone through it after Bill went back to work. And I didn't go to work till 9:30, so I had to put it in shape before I could go to work and blah, 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 blah. So I didn't always make the Monday night meeting. But one of those Monday nights, they had their regular meeting, and I was the only thing on the agenda. Those women sat down together and tried to determine which one of them had the courage to be my sponsor. Truth. Truth. Now, Guy Neal was a clinical psychologist. I didn't know that for a long time, or I wouldn't have stayed in the same room with her. But she decided that she had the courage to be my sponsor. So she came over to my house and told me she was my sponsor. And I didn't care. I knew I wouldn't have her very long. because I learned early on when I first came to Texas, it was very easy to shock Southern Baptists. And I had a ball. I just shocked their shoes off. So Guy sat down in my dining room, drinking my coffee, and put me through a little catechism. She said, "Have you come to terms with the first step, Arbutus?" And I said, "Well, certainly. The step says, blah, blah, blah." I said, "Everybody's powerless over alcohol, Guy. It's a chemical." And to polish it off, I said, "I'm also powerless over strychnine and carbolic acid." And she let me get by with it. And by the time that was, she put my nose down in those 12 steps, and I had the distinct feeling that if I didn't take those blasted steps, she wouldn't let me come up for air. And I was willing to take them. I was going to take those steps and get an A+ up in the corner of my paper. I'd never seen anything else on one of my papers. I was going to slap that down in front of that gray-eyed sponsor and say, "I took these blasted steps and they didn't work." And they did. They did. I didn't come here to get Bill O'Neill sober. I want you to know that. I came here to try to find the disintegrated pieces of a personality that was once me, and I somehow lost it. I came here because my children were afraid of me. Now, don't misunderstand me. I am not a child abuser. My children were afraid of my disapproval. They were afraid to bring home a grade card if they made a C on it because I would not tolerate it. I said, "Anybody can be average." I couldn't watch a school play if they were acting in it. If I sat out in the audience, they forgot their lines. I had to watch from the wings. My children were afraid of me. I punished them unmercifully if they spilled a glass of milk on a white tablecloth, and I insisted on white tablecloths. Never did make sense to me that I'd try to convince my own children that I'm an aristocrat, but I did. A tornado took care of my white tablecloths for a period of time. I made mention of that in Jonesboro, Arkansas one time, and good Lord of mercy, I got tablecloths from every corner of the globe. Any of you need some white tablecloths? I've got them. And my Bill was ashamed of me. And I didn't want my children to be afraid of me. And I didn't want Bill to be ashamed of me. And I took those blasted steps, and my life changed. That's what they told me. If you work this program, your life will change. And that's what I wanted. The first thing I noticed was that the children were no longer afraid of me. They got so brave they sassed me, and that took a lot of nerve. And then a little later I realized that once again Bill was proud of me. This sick need for approval that those of us who love alcoholics is a real thing, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real thing. And the approval that we want is from the alcoholic. And it doesn't take much. Just tell us that we did a good job, that we look nice, smell good. Don't take much. And I was glad when I knew that Bill was proud of me. And we took the principles of this program and we reared those four children. And for a long time, things were good with the O'Neills, weren't they, Bob? Things were good with the O'Neills. When Teresa was graduated from the university magna cum laude, I said, "That ain't bad for a drunk's kid." Luther went into the Navy and came out and started with the help of his dad's help. He started a little business. He had 25 men older than he was working for him. I'd get a lump in my throat when I'd see him run across a parking lot or jump a fence because he wasn't supposed to walk. But when he started that little business, I said, "That ain't bad for a drunk's kid." Things were good with the O'Neills. Our daughters have more more degrees than the thermometer, Luther used to say. But then our kids got mixed up with some other people's kids, and all hell broke loose. We married off all four of them. Three of them got a divorce. I think the only reason Teresa and Les stayed married is because they thought I'd kill them if they got a divorce. Nancy was married to a young psychiatrist who literally referred hundreds of people to our program. I started getting some strange calls about that time. I'd get a call from Austin, Texas, and one of my AA friends would say, "You can go to sleep now, Arbus. We followed Luther home," and he turned in his own driveway. Then I'd get a call from the other side of Texas to tell me that Nancy had slept in the ladies' room at the country club and cut her eye and had to have umpteen stitches. But she's going to be all right. The floor was wet, you understand. But I'd been ill a long time, and I knew I couldn't help those kids. And it liked to kill me. It absolutely liked to kill me. Nancy fled the country because her husband had every intentions of institutionalizing her, and he could have done it. So she went to Mexico to live. She lived down there for 5 years, and I don't speak Spanish. I have a fabulous imagination. I put Nancy on Skid Row. I'd heard AA ladies stand at podiums like this and talk about how vulnerable they were and how they had been exploited. And I had heard stories about Mexican jails. And I couldn't even repeat the Serenity Prayer. One of the smart alecks up in Oklahoma that you all know said, "Now we're going to see what kind of program Arbutus has." But I knew I couldn't help Nancy. When Bill made tapes and those fast copiers that he had made tapes in even numbers, and quite often he'd have order maybe for 67 tapes and come out 68, and I'd push those tapes back on the counter and call them counter tapes for some reason. And one day I was cleaning the tape room and I found a number of tapes of Clancy Emerson, so I packaged them up and sent them to Nancy. And she called me in a few days and she said, "Why hadn't you sent me this man's tapes before, Mother?" And I said, "Well, I guess I didn't think about it." And she said, "He makes sense. He's so simple." Couldn't wait to tell Clancy how simple he was. And she said, "I can understand sublimate your judgment. I cannot understand turn your will and your life over." And Clancy, bless his heart, sent Nancy tapes all the time that she was in Mexico. And I know a lot of people say ugly things about Clancy, but as far as I'm concerned, he's top man. If he won't stand on his head in the corner, that's all right with me, because he saved my little girl's life. He really did. It took a lot of learning. And, of course, when Luther had a major heart attack, you all heard me talk about that the last time I was out here. But Luther was 15 years sober when he died 2 years ago. And Nancy is working on her, I think, 18th in September. And this was not in my game plan, of course. These kids grew up in an AA home with an Al-Anon mother, and I thought that gave them some kind of protection, but it doesn't. We went to Tapa, Texas Roundup in 1993. It was the 30th roundup we had attended. Bill got sober in Amarillo, Texas, and it was kind of a pilgrimage for him. Bill had a hemorrhage while we were up there that weekend, and took him directly to the hospital. When we got back to Brownwood, he would not go to the hospital in Amarillo. And they diagnosed it as a severe case of diverticulitis and told me it was a chronic condition and it could reoccur. That was in October. And the following April, he hemorrhaged again, and I assumed that it was a reoccurrence. It was not. Ulcers in his stomach had ruptured. And Bill just gradually wore out, bless his heart. He had congenital heart failure. ulcerated stomach, early stages of emphysema, you all punish your bodies so badly and you have to pay the consequences eventually. But my Bill died January the 23rd last year. And I live in the house that he grew up in. And he's still there. And I don't handle it very well. I was going to stop coming out to these conferences when Bill got sick. And Bill wasn't angry with me very many times, but he was angry with me. He said, I cannot believe you'd be so ungrateful. He said, everything we have, we owe to this program. Everything. And you seem to have a unique ability to describe what alcoholism does to a family, and you do not have a right to stay home. Peggy said, if God didn't mean for me to do these things, then my telephone wouldn't ring. So I come out to California every chance I get. I'm going to be in Bakersfield in May, and I talk too long and don't care. Tell you everything I know and make up half of it. And I'll say the same thing that I always say to you. We have a message that the whole world needs to know. And you are the most uniquely qualified people in the world to carry that message. And I believe with all my heart that right here in your beautiful capital city, there's drunken men and women who will die as did Stephen Foster, never knowing they're alcoholic if we fail to carry this message. And there's drunken men and women right here in your capital city and in mine that will not have the courage to face life one more day with an alcoholic, and they'll break up their homes if you fail to carry this message. And there's kids that never heard of Alateen. And this is Saturday. And Saturday nights were the worst of all. And these kids will grow up with deformed personalities if you fail to carry this message. And if you fail to carry this message, may God have mercy on these people. And may God have mercy on us.